in our notch in the history of physics, the opportunity we have is that there are new gravitational measurements being made in a regime never tested before. And the question is that we're all trying to address is how do you learn about fundamental physics from the measurements people are doing in this black hole environment? And the traditional way you approach that in physics when you have a new area that you're exploring experimentally is there's actually, you contrast two approaches. One approach is you take specific proposals for what the theory is that you're trying to test that's not the standard one. So in gravity, that could be a scalar tensor theory, or it could be string theory, or it could be your favorite theory of quantum gravity. And the other approach is you say that the advantage of taking specific models that they're very predictive, there's very a small number of parameters that predict all the observables. The alternative approach is you, under the assumption that most of the new degrees of freedom that are in the problem are not accessible to you because they're heavy or they're very short wavelength, you write down an effective field theory which parameterizes how any such model would appear in observables, and it's less predictive. It is predictive at low energies, but less predictive than a specific model would be. And it's by contrasting the effective field theory approach to the model-by-model approach that you learn something, because if you find that something, prediction of a model is true, but it's something which is generic to all models, then you haven't learned which model is right. But if you learn that the prediction that's agreeing with the experiment is one that's specific to a model and not generic to low energy theories, then you've learned a lot that the model is probably right. So it's the contrast of effective field theories and a model-by-model approach, which is useful. But in the black hole case, before we get to echoes, the problem is that it's a strongly coupled system, and so a lot of the predictions for, say, binary mergers at the point where they're actually merging and a lot of the signals coming has to be done numerically, and there's technical difficulties in making predictions with effective field theories numerically, because effective field theories typically have higher derivatives in them, and then that introduces spurious solutions, which theoretically you know how to treat, but numerically you don't, in the sense that the numerics doesn't know that there are some solutions that you trust and some you don't, and so you get them all, and the ones that are the sick ones tend to grow fastest, and so it's hard to dig the signal out of all the noise. And so it's kind of a puzzle right now. How do you extract effective field theory, robust predictions from these new gravitational wave black hole observables? And what's nice about this echo story is that it's a different take on the same problem. So for echoes, so the normal effective field theory story would have been that on an energy scale, you've got some heavy scale that you don't understand, some light scale you do understand. You're expecting the things will simplify if you expand in ratio of light, the small scale divided by the heavy scale. But the problem is you don't really know what the heavy scale is. So what you really do is you imagine that you want to do the Taylor expansion in powers of little scale divided by big scale as early in the problem as possible. And effective field theories are the way to systematize that and do it in a Lagrangian before you do it observable by observable. And what you typically find is that there's some lowest order thing plus a bunch of corrections which are suppressed by this scale. Actually, I should say this is sum over not one to infinity, but there's a bunch of things, and there's a power here which is positive, and there's some couplings which I'll come back to, and a bunch of interaction terms.
That's capital M in the denominator?
That's a capital M, this is supposed to be the heavy scale. So this is like the derivative expansion. And what would normally happen is that when you calculate an observable, it would depend on all the scales of your problem, the energy of the observable, let's say, and this little m and this big M and anything else you have going on, all the dimensionless things. And the way historically people would have done this 50 years ago is they would have calculated all the observables, then Taylor expanded in powers of these small things divided by the big thing. So you get, O naught of plus, E over M corrections. And that's the hard way to do it, because you have to know the answer before you Taylor expand it. But if you do it in the Lagrangian first and then calculate the observables having already done the expansion, you save time. Now, no one almost ever, almost nobody does this. If this is the thing you would do if you knew everything, if you knew what the heavy scale was and what light scale was. The problem is you don't know what the heavy scale is. So what people really do is they stick in, they imagine there's some big scale, some cutoff above which they don't know what's going on. And they use the cutoff as a proxy for what the physical scale is that they're trying to ignore. And if you're only doing dimensional analysis, that's not such a bad thing to do. But it's dangerous if you start thinking that lambda is M, because lambda is just some random scale that anybody could choose. And all you really ask of it is that it's bigger than the scales that you know about, and it's smaller than the scales you don't know about. But nothing really depends on lambda, because it's really just a way you're dividing. If you integrate out modes, you're imagining that if you knew the theory of the world, you'd integrate down to lambda, and you'd calculate an effective Lagrangian, which would depend on lambda. And then you'd use that effective Lagrangian to calculate your observables. But you don't know how to do this first step. So the thing that you do know is that if you could have done everything, lambda would not be in your answer, because it's just really an artificial way of dividing up the calculation. And where it can, people can get into trouble is if you overinterpret a cutoff, thinking of it as being a proxy for a physical scale, you can be led into odd statements sometimes. And so that's a common danger of effective field theories, in that one of the fundamental properties of the effective field theory is that the scale lambda, if you're thinking of it as being a cutoff, is not in the answer. And the physical thing you're trying to capture is not a series in E over lambda, because lambda is not in your answer. But it's often true that if you ask how variables depend on your cutoff, that tells you things about how it depends on the thing you really want to know, and how it depends on the heavy scales. And I'm kind of laboring this because the echoes story provides a different way in to black hole physics in an effective Lagrangian way, but it has the same issue in it, which is the thing I want to. I have no axe to grind on echoes. You know, they may be there, may not be there. All I'm thinking about them is I'm thinking that it's a useful way to develop thinking about gravity in an effective field theory kind of way. So in the echo story, the proposal is that instead of energy, you know, you've got radius away from the black hole, and there's some places where the horizon would have been if we really believe that general relativity was right. And you're imagining that if you look at some profile of some field, let's say in general relativity it would have done something like that, say that's the GR answer. You're imagining that there's some physics which is dominantly changing things near the horizon and not changing it much far from the horizon. So new physics could have done a lot of things. It could have given you new light degrees of freedom in addition to corrections to the interactions amongst the ordinary degrees of freedom that you already know about. And the echo story is not so much about that. It's supposing that there's not long range things going on. It's more to do with, is there something localized to the horizon, which is coming from new physics, where if you were to calculate some variable, some field or something, in real life it's looking like general relativity, but then it starts to do something different, and maybe it diverges to something else, but this is phi, you know, not GR. And you're imagining that this deviation is happening not so far from the horizon, so in some ill-defined window of width epsilon, where the idea is epsilon is much smaller than the horizon size. And the class of theories that do this might be the empty set. You know, there's a lot of attractive pictures, like the fuzzballs, where you imagine that it's not a black hole, it's just a very complicated thing with many states. But they're all, as far as I can understand them, they're very vague on how this happens. And so I think it's an open question whether or not these kind of...
I was asking why epsilon should be much less than RH. Is this just how echo theories are constructed, or is it the reason why you do that later on?
No, thanks for asking that, because I think the echo theories, they don't assume that at all. But I'm going to use this as a window. I'm going to use that assumption to be the analog of the assumption that you've got a low scale compared to a high scale, and I'm going to try and exploit that me. So that's really what I'm going to do. It's not really intrinsic to echo stories. So I'm going to propose that if you had a fundamental theory that did this, you can go through this program where you can ask the questions about what it would mean robustly without knowing the details of what the without knowing specifically what the microscopic model is that would be giving you this behavior. And so it allows you to do the profit from the this hierarchy of scales in a way that is similar to the traditional way in effective field theories. And the hierarchy I'm going to try and exploit here is this this hypothetical small scale over which new physics is happening compared to the basic scale of the problem, which is the horizon size.
So are you worried that there are really two hierarchies, the one you were just talking about and then this one, so in fact they are both actually at the same time?
That could also happen. I'm going to imagine that there's really only one. But the main difference here is that it's happening in position space rather than energy space is really the thing I want to exploit. Because the nature of the echoes thing where you're basically saying that the new physics boils down to a boundary condition, kind of you strip it all down.
And physically it should be both, right?
Right. It should be everywhere. It should be that there's, so progress thinking this way, away from the horizon is hard because that's the issue of how do you do numerically, work with effective field theories. So I want to focus just on this new issue which the echoes thing is raising, which is this localization of physics and can you exploit hierarchies of scale in the same way? And I want to argue that you can. I'm not arguing that there are UV completions which do this. I don't know if that's true. If they exist, then this is the way to describe them. And one of the nice things about this way of, and there's a, the main message is that there's a similar danger to the danger you have here about cutoffs here, because what you typically do, the physically intuitive thing that people do is you imagine that things are changing, and I don't know the details of what's going on in here, so what I'll do is I'll ask this as a boundary condition out here. I'll say that at this point here, and this is what I'm going to now really mean by epsilon, is the horizon plus epsilon, I'll impose some boundary condition here on my field, and it's supposed to capture the effects of this microscopic physics. And then anything I do, then I can calculate everything I want out here about observables, but everything I calculate will now depend on the boundary condition I chose and the value of epsilon. And the issue is, what does it mean? What does that value of epsilon mean? And I want to argue that epsilon is very much like this cutoff. It actually doesn't mean anything. Nothing depends on that epsilon. And it's not a physical scale at all. What's really happening is, just like here, if you think about what happens if you change the cutoff here, changing the cutoff here just means you've integrated out more modes. All your effective couplings, all these things, they were really, if you did this as a function of lambda, they would have been functions of lambda. And so what's happening is all the couplings are adjusting and adjust the way they have to make sure that physics down here doesn't care where you chose lambda. And that's kind of the detailed way in which lambda drops out of the problem. There's a similar story here, that if you impose a boundary condition at some radius epsilon, the boundary condition, I'm going to argue, the nice thing about thinking about this as an effective theory is that it gives you a way to organize boundary conditions. How do you choose what the boundary condition should be? I want to argue that that the boundary condition is controlled by an action, and all the things you do in an action and an effective theory you can do for the boundary action, and it tells you which ones should be more important at low energies, and in particular, the things that dominate at low energy have the fewest fields and derivatives, and that leads you to linear boundary conditions, which are the ones that people use. And so typically, the boundary condition that you're going to be led to here is something along the lines of some number times the radial derivative of the whatever this field is, plus another number times the field itself at epsilon is equal to zero. And what typically happens when you make predictions is that the physical predictions depend on the ratio of A over B and on epsilon. But that, what I'm trying to argue is that there's really only one variable there. That what's really happening is very much like what happens here. A and B are the analogs of these effective couplings. And they are, you should think of them as being depending on epsilon. That you have some real physics which is giving you some profile, and you're trying to fake it by looking at boundary conditions, which you could have chosen anywhere, because there's not like an edge to the new physics. Normally things are falling off in some continuous way. If this had been a nucleus and we were looking at what was happening in an atom, the wave function of a nucleus is falling off exponentially. You can't say that it ended here because it's just tapering off. And so what you do is you impose a boundary condition at some radius, and the boundary condition that you need to capture the physics, as you change the radius, the fundamental physics didn't change, and so you're adjusting the boundary condition in the way it has to compensate for the fact that you're imposing it at different radii. And so the way to think of this is that these boundary conditions are actually functions of epsilon, and the epsilon dependence they have is exactly what they need to ensure that the predictions don't depend on epsilon. And so that means, so the point of the exercise is that supposing you see an echo tomorrow, and you ask, what did it tell you? What it did not tell you was the value, that the correct value for the boundary condition, where to replace the boundary condition. It is telling you a scale in the same way that a renormalization group is telling you about physical scales. But the cutoff is not what that physical scale was. And so the way I'd like to develop this story is to just take the problem for the black hole, rewrite it as a problem of where the horizon, rewrite it as a Schrodinger equation, where the horizon is the origin, and then it becomes very much like the description of if you had a compact source at the origin affecting a larger thing like a nucleus and an atom, which we know a lot about. And so then I'll take the problem set up that way, set up how the boundary conditions work, and then map them back to the black hole case. And then you'll see that there's a renormalization group invariant way of describing the reflection coefficients that you're getting. And they're not involving the place where you impose the boundary condition. That's the main message. Any questions before I start? That's kind of a, I'm a third of the way done, so. All right, so if you set up, so imagine now, so the what I'm describing is in these two papers. This one is talking about, there's a bunch of papers, but this is the one that talks about the Schrodinger problem essentially with a localized source. And there's a series of papers that talk about that, but this one specifically talks about the situation where the source is not unitary, so you can things can be absorbed at the source, which is going to be the analog what you're going to need for the black hole discussion. And this is one that adapts this, implies it in the way I'm describing to black holes and echoes. Okay, so let's imagine that. And in this paper, it's set up for it does the Kerr case as well as the Schwarzschild case. It does the Tucholsky equation rather than the Klein-Gordon equation. But I'm just going to talk about the Klein-Gordon equation in Schwarzschild because that's simpler. But for more details of the other things, go look in there. All right, so let's imagine that the thing we're trying to follow here is some Klein-Gordon field on Schwarzschild. So it satisfies, you know, box phi equals zero, let's say it's massless. And so we can write this in the Schwarzschild metric, and what we'll separate it, we'll separate variables. So we'll imagine that phi is some radial function and some angular thing. And I'll look for energy eigenstates, where energy is set by the killing vector, the killing direction in the Schwarzschild. And typically what happens is, so let me just for completeness write the equation. So the radial equation is the one that has most of the juice in it. So it becomes d2r dr squared plus 2r minus r Schwarzschild. R Schwarzschild is just, you know, 2gm over r minus r Schwarzschild. So that's the radial equation we're trying to solve. Second order equation, two solutions. And so we'll call the solutions, so R will be, you know, C plus R plus C minus R minus. And the asymptotic forms of R plus and minus for small R minus RS. So let me call X R minus RS. It's gonna go like X to the S plus or minus, where S plus or minus is given by one half. No, I don't want that one. Yeah, so it's plus or minus one half square root of 1 minus 4 V1, which I'm going to call this combination. I'm going to call plus or minus zeta, and where V1 is given by turns out to be one fourth plus RS squared, RS to the fourth, sorry, RS squared Oh, sorry, I've got the dimensions wrong here. What to do? It's 1/4 plus RS squared omega squared. Okay. So in particular, if I've done that right, because of that 1/4, you can kind of see what this is going to turn into is plus or minus. It's going to be imaginary, yeah. If omega is real, it'll be imaginary. If omega is complex, it'll be complex. So it'll be I RS omega plus or minus. And that's the fact that this is not real is to do with the fact that it's absorptive, the black hole is absorptive, that the origin is going to turn out. So there you are. So that's the equation you're trying to solve. The boundary condition is going to come in because you want to know how to choose these integration constants, and normally you would have chosen that in some way.
Did you say what x is?
X is the distance from the horizon. And gravity doesn't work in this room, apparently.
Yeah.
I think it's.
I think
it's almost stable, but it's not quite.
Write more on it. It's a chalk wave.
All right. Yeah, right. That's the way we lose brushes, right? All right. So now to make contact with this story, you know what you'd like to know is what's the boundary condition. And what you traditionally would have done is you would have said, I'll impose perfectly infalling boundary conditions at the horizon. That would be how you would choose C plus over C minus, and then away you would go. That would be GR. So GR would be perfectly infalling boundary condition at R equals R S or R.
C minus equal to zero. One of those would be zero. I don't know. I guess C plus would be
zero. Yeah, I'm going to set it up so that. I forgot how I'm going to set it up. Yeah, one of them will be zero. I'll tell you the right one to get when we get there. Yeah. But more generally, you're imagining that you're going to not have the boundary condition, and then the question is, you know, so how do you know the juice of the boundary condition will come in through the value of C plus over C minus, and so the observables will depend on that C plus over C minus, and you're trying to just track how that epsilon dependence shows up in observables by tracking through here. So let me now do the segue to translating this problem into the problem of a small source Schrodinger field interacting with a small source, where we know what the answer is, and we have a lot of ways to test it. And so the way I'm going to do that is just take this thing, you know, just do the standard change of variables that gets rid of the first derivative term, and you make this look like a Schrodinger equation. And so if we do that, if we say that, R is f of r times chi of r, and I'm going to put a d dependence here, for d is the number of space dimensions. What I'm going to do is I'm going to choose f. So if we choose f such that the chi equation that I get from this equation looks like minus del squared chi plus some potential v of chi is equal to zero. And so in d dimensions, this would have been d2 chi dr squared plus d minus 1 over r d chi dr. Now, the thing is that this is what it would have looked like in spherical coordinates where r equals 0 is a singular place. But in this equation, r equals the horizon is a singular place. So I'm going to change variables to x. You know, remember, x is r minus r horizon. And so I'm going to be trying to look for a behavior that looks like this. So I'm going to ask the when I normalize this to be 1, I want this coefficient to be this. And I'm going to be able to find the solution, an f that does that for any d. And that's kind of why I'm calling this f sub d. And so that's going to make this look like a Schrodinger problem in d dimensions. And in the end of the day, I'm going to choose d equals 3 or d equals 1. It's going to turn out d equals 3 and d equals 1 give the same answer. But that's the plan. And the solution that does this is, so the solution is, just write this out here. So it's a constant. Different constant from that one. I'll call it C sub f, just to remind you. Times r minus rs to the d minus 1 over 2 divided by the square root of r minus rs. And I'm kind of using rs and rh as the same. I've used both those notations, so they both mean 2gm.
Why do you make a Schrodinger equation d dimension and not one dimension? Usually people do it in one dimension.
Turns out, because I could do it for any d, because we could do it for any d, we did it. And it turns out that you'll see that the d dependence comes in as a factor of d minus 1, d minus 3, so those two choices don't do anything. They're the same answer, so it doesn't actually matter to you. There's a critical dimension in this problem, which is 2, and it happens that 1 and 3 are equidistant from it. So it, anyway, so that's a choice. So with this change of variables, chi is going to satisfy this. And so what I want to do is have the same conversation for chi, where I can now forget the, well, actually, there's one more thing I want to say here. So having found f, I can calculate what v is. And so let me tell you what v is. And so with that choice, v turns out to be minus rs to the fourth over 4 plus r to the fourth double omega squared. And continue on down, plus L plus 1 over R minus RS. So the only d dependence is here. And so you can kind of see that 1 and 3 is just going to kill this term. So in practice, it's just going to be these things. And I'm going to focus on S, the S wave, just to make things simple. So that won't matter. So what really matters is here. And the main thing to notice is that as R goes to infinity, this is these things all die, but here the r to the fourth down here cancels the r to the fourth, and this goes to minus omega squared, so it goes to a constant. And as r goes to rs, what happens is that these 1 over r minus rs squareds are the ones that win. This one's not there because we're going to choose in the end of the day 3 or 1 for d. And so this goes like, I'm going to call it minus g over x squared, where that's the same x. And g is going to be this thing in we can read it off, right? It's just going to be basically, so this will become, if x goes to 0, r goes to rs, so the rs squared takes out 2 of the rs's here, and so we're going to get this is g is 1 fourth plus omega squared rs squared. And that's where this came from. So what I'm calling V1 here is really came in secret from the G of the, so the message is that there's a potential. If you sketch it, it does the usual thing. You know, if this is R, starts off at some negative thing, goes up, and then it goes, drops like 1 over R squared, where this is R equals RS. So the usual thing for the echoes is that, you know, even if you had nothing's happening at the horizon, you've got to worry about going through this potential. The potential is not an inverse square potential, but near the horizon, it is an inverse square potential. And I'm going to focus on epsilon small because I want to be in the region where you're in this asymptotic limit that the potential looks like it's an inverse square potential. Because then the problem that we're asking about for black holes becomes, you know, the Schrodinger problem in an inverse square potential, which is scale invariant, has all the issues that come up. And it's what's special about the inverse square problem, if you haven't thought about it, is it's not only is it scale invariant, but forgetting black holes, it already introduced the problem of, it shows you that there is a fundamental issue of how you choose the boundary condition at the origin. In the hydrogen atom, what you do is you ask the wave function to be smooth at the origin, and that's how you choose which of these solutions to keep. But the inverse square problem is the existence proof that says that that can't be the right answer fundamentally, because if you look at the small r limit of this equation, and you look at the powers, any analog of that in this case, for non-zero g, what happens is that both the solutions to the equation are singular at the origin. So there's no combination which is not singular. So that shows you that that non-singularity is not the criterion you should be using. And so the long story short of this Schrodinger with a singular potential story is that there's a general framework for describing What this is really saying physically is that if you have an inverse square potential, you're particularly sensitive to what's going on at the origin. And the fact that things are singular there normally means that there's a something there. And so it could be a nucleus, could be some object. And because the wave function piles up there, the predictions actually care more than they normally do about what's going on at the origin. But that just emphasizes that whatever the answer is, it'll depend on the physics of what's at the origin. So if you tell me the action of the object down here, there's an algorithm that tells you what the boundary condition in the near, the r goes to zero limit should have been. And the simplest version of that you're familiar with, because the simplest version of that is just the multipole expansion. If you had had a, so the claim I'm making, and I'm not justifying, but is in those papers, is if you know the action of the source at the center, at r equals zero. So let's say in this, let's say it's three dimensions and it's living on a world line. So you've got some action which is the integral along the world line of some Lagrangian, which you know, I'm imagining it depends on the fields evaluated at tau, which you could also write it in space-time as being a Lagrangian with a delta function at the position of the source. If you know what this Lagrangian is, my claim is the boundary condition is dictated to you. It's not something you get to choose, it's something which you just learn. And there's an, in three dimensions, it turns out that the boundary condition is something like 4 pi r squared d field dr at r equals epsilon, which is close, you know, arbitrarily close to zero, but not at zero because the solutions are diverging at zero, is equal to, in this case of an inverse square potential, it'll be this g. So it'll be basically dl d phi evaluated at r equals epsilon. And so if you took this Lagrangian and thought of it as being an effective Lagrangian, and it, let's say you have some symmetry phi goes to minus phi, let's say you don't have a symmetry phi goes to minus phi. Let's say you start off saying this is the electromagnetic potential, so it's linear in A. Then what this would have turned into was the, would be the statement that you know, the A naught dr times r squared is equal to dl d A naught, and the coefficient dl d A naught is just a charge. So this would have been the charge. And then this is just telling you that if you had an inverse square potential, if you solve the field equations and you found that there was an inverse square potential with some unknown integration constant, this is telling you what the integration constant is. It says you take the inverse square potential, the inverse, the 1 over r potential, differentiate it, you get the integration constant over r squared, the r squareds cancel, 4 pi times that constant is the charge, and that's what Coulomb's law says. So this is just Gauss's law in this particular example. But the argument generalizes. If you have an arbitrary function here that's not linear, it still works. It's more subtle because the fields are often diverging at the origin, and so you've got something diverging at the origin times a delta function, so you have to renormalize things, and that's where the scale dependence is going to come in. So in our case where we've got a Klein-Gordon field, let's say there's a phi goes to minus phi symmetry to make it simple. The lowest dimension thing here, which is what we should be looking at lowest energy, low energies, will just be something like h phi squared. Then this will become something like h phi, something like that, evaluated at epsilon. And so, and this is phi now. And so this says that the near source behavior of your integration, of your solution, the integration constants are being chosen by the requirement that that's controlled by the value of this coupling h. And the story of if you change epsilon, if this had been a nucleus and we've been looking at the field outside a nucleus, again, the nucleus doesn't have an edge, so if fields fall off, you could impose this boundary condition anywhere, but you're doing it in such a way that you're trying to capture the nucleus, and the nucleus didn't care about where you wrote epsilon. And so what's happening is that you could calculate this boundary condition constant h as a function of the nucleus, and then it would also depend on epsilon, because the value you need to reproduce the nucleus would depend on exactly where you impose the boundary condition. And the rule for determining how this depends on epsilon is to ask that physical things don't depend on epsilon. That's the renormalization group statement. And so that's the, I want to basically quote what that rule is, show you how things flow, and then I'll just tell you what the answer is now for the black hole if you do the same thing.
In your analysis, you say r goes to zero, the origin. Do you mean the origin or do you mean rh?
In this problem, it's the origin, but it's it was over here, it was going to be RH.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it's the place where the thing was singular. Because what I'm doing is I'm using the fact that near the horizon, this is looking like an inverse square potential, yeah. And I have this technology for the inverse square potential. Yeah. use this board here. Okay, so let me just tell you what happened. So in practice, what happens, if I just write this out, right? This is the boundary condition I'm working with. What I'm supposed to do is take this solution here and plug it in. And so it's going to involve C plus and C minus. So I'm going to get some expression that looks like, let me just write it down. So I'm just translating what that formula was. And it's the statement that because I have something which is linear, you know, d psi d phi and phi, I'm going to divide by phi, and I'm going to write it as d dr of log phi. And so the statement is that, so 4 pi, just is now copying just what you had over there, ddr log psi phi epsilon is equal to h. And there's and then what I'm going to stick in is I substitute in phi as a function of c plus and c minus. So use r is equal to r plus c plus r minus c minus. And I'm also going to use the r goes to zero. I'll use x here to emphasize that it's not the origin, it's the horizon. I should really think of it here as x. Asymptotic form. For the r's. So these things for small r have some simple power law behavior like this. And I'm going to use all that information and just write out this formula. And it just says that it becomes the statement that h over 4 pi epsilon squared is equal to 1 over epsilon. And here now I'm putting in all this asymptotic stuff. S plus 2i k epsilon s plus minus s minus plus c plus over c minus. So just all this is doing is telling you that if you knew what h was, or one way to read this is that if you knew what h was, which is telling you what the boundary condition is, you now know what c plus over c minus is. And so now you can go off and go to town and find all your observables, which are functions of c plus and c minus. But they will depend on epsilon and on h. That's one way to read this. That's a traditional way to read this formula. The other way to read this formula is that this is supposed to be true for all epsilon, because I didn't know where I was doing the boundary condition. And I could do that as long as h was a function of epsilon. So I can read this as a formula that tells me what h of epsilon is. The thing is, you know, something has to be held fixed as I change epsilon. And the thing that has to be held fixed is the physics of the microscopic physics I'm trying to capture. That's the observables. They should not change as I change epsilon. And that's what c plus over c minus is, because those observables are all functions of c plus over c minus. So if I fix this and say that's a constant, then this is telling me how h depends on epsilon. And so I want to just draw a picture of what that looks like. The simplest way to do that is to write it as a differential equation, because it's kind of, there's a set of variables in which it's more intuitive what that flow looks like. So okay, so if I define the variable lambda hat. And the hat is just because, for historical reasons, we had something else was lambda. So I'm going to define, so this h that I'm talking about there, h over 4 pi epsilon squared that appeared up on the left-hand side of that equation, I'm going to define the variable, I'm going to call that 2 minus d, actually I'm going to say minus 1, I'm choosing d equals 3 here now, just to be concrete, plus lambda hat. So if I define lambda hat by this, then the epsilon dependence of h that you get gives you an epsilon dependence for lambda hat, but it's a simple one. So that implies that epsilon, so varying epsilon with c plus over c minus fixed implies that epsilon d lambda hat d epsilon is 1 half zeta squared minus lambda hat squared, where zeta is that thing I wrote over here, over there. It's a function of this g, so it's, in general, for general d, it would have been d minus 2 squared plus 4 L plus 1 minus g. But I don't have that because I'm taking L equals 0, and I don't have that because that's 1. So this is going to be the square root of 1 minus 4g. And remember, that's the combination that we were getting over here that I was telling you about. G is the coefficient of the inverse square potential in our problem. So g is the one that's going to be given by this expression here at the end of the day.
So why do you define lambda at that way?
Just because it made this equation simple. So it's just convenience. It's just because this equation is, you can see where the fixed points are. The fixed points are at lambda hat equals plus or minus zeta.
Right, but I'm saying if you define your cup, I mean lambda differently with different factor of epsilon, then I guess
it would flow differently, but it would be just a reparameterization of the same flow.
But it wouldn't be the same. What you would call a fixed point would be the same.
Yes, it would. It would be. It would just be a fixed point written in different variables. But since the physics won't care about the variables, the physical predictions when you relate an observable to another observable, that won't change as you reparameterize things.
For observables, I agree, but then I guess this lambda hat itself is not an observable.
No, it's not, right.
So that's a proxy for h, basically.
Right.
But if it has an extra epsilon, like h over epsilon.
Right.
Lambda hat minus 1.
Right.
So I'm saying that if lambda hat becomes a constant, h in fact is proportional to epsilon.
Yes,
right?
Definitely. Right. So the fixed point is not a fixed point for h. That's one of the things you learn is that.
So how do I decide that then I care about fixed points of lambda hat and not fixed points of h?
Well, so one thing you can ask is what does this flow mean? So let me write that flow down, and you'll see that there's an intuitive answer. So if I kind of plot, so let's first suppose that zeta is real. It's not real in the black hole case. So I'll go back to that. Zeta being real means that this attractive potential is attractive but not too attractive. So that means this is small enough. So if it's real, then what happens is that the flows, there's two classes of flows. It turns out that an RG invariant, lambda is either larger than zeta or it's larger than, the absolute value of lambda is larger than zeta or smaller than zeta, and the flow never changes that. So there's kind of, if you take the minus zeta and plus zeta, I'm plotting against log epsilon, so infinity to minus infinity is the allowed range, and then this is lambda hat. The flow is kind of, they start from minus infinity, they're here, and then they all go as epsilon goes to plus infinity to plus zeta. So they do something like that. They might do it over here, there's some freedom. And the ones that are here, they if they start off here, they go down to infinity and then they come back down again. That's the pattern of the flows. And so what they're saying is that there's the two fixed points, you transfer from one to the other. And physically what's going on is, all this epsilon dependence is radius dependence. And these fixed points, if you kind of translated them back into what these mode functions are doing, they're just the statement that the mode functions had an asymptotic form, which I've written here somewhere. It's this statement here. So what this is saying is that if I take epsilon really, really small, one of these things is typically going to zero as epsilon goes to zero. The other one is typically blowing up as epsilon goes to zero. So as you get really close to zero, one of the solutions is dominating everything. And if you go really, really out to infinity, it's the opposite. The one that was growing starts to win. The one that was zero here starts to win. And the one that was there's some different combination dominates at infinity. And that's what the fixed point at infinity is. And so the crossover from the two fixed points is just saying that as a function of where you were, There's a solution which is kind of smooth, there's a solution which is sick, and the relative size of these things is changing if you pose your boundary condition at different places. That's all it's sort of saying. And so so in that sense, the fixed points of lambda are tied to the asymptotic forms of these functions, and that's kind of why the combination you've got in the powers is the zeta. That's kind of, they're related to each other. And that's also why it depends on L, because the behavior all depends on L. So I need to finish. So the long story short is that there's a flow like this, and it does something which is reasonable. The renormalization group invariant way to characterize this flow is just tell me the place where this goes through zero or goes to infinity. That'll be that'll characterize the curve. The statement is that any physical observable will depend on C plus over C minus. That's a function of H and epsilon in exactly the way it had to be, that epsilon is not in the answer. And that means that if you did a measurement at this value of epsilon, and you say that's epsilon naught, and you found that lambda hat or h at epsilon naught was equal to lambda naught. Naively, you think that you've got an observable that depends on those two numbers, but it doesn't. It only depends on one combination, and that is it only depends on which curve you're on here. And a characterization of that curve, which is invariant, is where it crosses the origin. Call that epsilon star. So it should be true that if I actually write observables out as functions of epsilon and lambda, they turn into functions of epsilon star only, and they do, is the message. So in this case where zeta is real, the only physical thing was epsilon star. If you did this for a nucleus, what would happen is that epsilon star turns out, say you're interested in the electromagnetic properties of the nucleus affecting atoms. An epsilon star you might have thought would be the nuclear radius. It turns out that's not true. Epsilon, the physical scale there is something like z alpha, maybe squared, I can't remember, z alpha, some power of z alpha times the nuclear radius. So it's much smaller than the nuclear radius because it knows about the coupling strength as well. But that's the physical content of this flow. And that's what you're learning when you measure that echoes are there or not there. Since I'm out of time, it's yada, yada, yada. Same thing goes true for black holes. You just map it all over to the black hole case. The new thing is that zeta is imaginary. So the flow diagram, that means that there's two invariants. So if I plot now a real lambda hat versus the imaginary part of lambda hat, the flow I told you about there was just basically along the line here. But now if zeta is complex, then lambda need not be complex. It's renormalization group invariant to be real, but if you didn't start real, you won't stay real. And what the flow does, so the fixed points when zeta are real are places on the real axis because zeta equals plus or minus lambda is equal to plus or minus zeta. But when zeta is imaginary, which is what happens for the black hole, what happens is that the fixed points, they're still at plus or minus zeta, but now they're on the imaginary axis. And the flow lines basically go around in circles. And it turns out that this guy here is the perfect absorber, and this guy here is the perfect emitter. And the renormalization group invariant way to characterize things is you can ask what's the value of epsilon where the flow crosses the imaginary axis? That would be epsilon star. That's the case, real lambda hat at epsilon star. That will define epsilon star. But also these different flows, the value of the imaginary part now is a new variable. So the imaginary part of lambda epsilon star, call that y star. That's a new variable in your problem. And those are the two renormalization group invariant things you learn about. And in this case, what's counterintuitive is that the general relativity is here. And that kind of makes sense. The fact that general relativity is a fixed point says that if you ask, what's the boundary condition that gives me general relativity? And you ask, how does it change as I approach the horizon? The answer is it doesn't change, it's a fixed point. And that just says the horizon is not a special place, which is what you expect. But anywhere else, that's not general relativity, it's going to flow in some interesting way. And this is telling you that way. And so there's a formula for the reflection. The observables, including the reflection coefficients, can be expressed in terms of these two things. And rather than writing it down, I'm out of time. It's in those papers. So thank you for your time.
Questions, okay? This whole thing could be translated into artist later?
Yeah.
And that changes, it simplifies it?
I don't know, I haven't done it. Yeah. It might.
Is there, the solutions are just plain waves?
Oh, for the mode functions, yeah. I mean, the thing that wasn't the, it's, actually you might have done it actually, Marcus, right?
Yeah, I think the phenomenology we actually do in the torus coordinates. This EFT discussion, RG discussion is easiest if you just look at R minus RS.
We weren't really limited by the solutions because we're always looking at the asymptotic forms. It's true that if you want to get away from the asymptotic forms, then it gets more complicated. And in principle, nothing in this expression for how things run, which I've hidden, you didn't need to go to the asymptotic form here. You could have actually had the whole hypergeometric function there. And it's telling you in great detail how the things evolve. And it's probably true that there it makes a difference more what coordinates you're in if you really want to follow things in more detail.
In the curve case, it's in what?
It all goes through with, well, there's one complicating thing that we had to assume, which was not generic. So the difference is that when you get to this story about the boundary condition, in general, what happens is that things depend on angles here, because this epsilon turns into a rho, which depends on a theta. And so the statement, so the separation of variables story I gave you changes. The boundary condition could ruin the separation of variables unless you choose the boundary condition correctly. So when we did the analysis for Kerr, we assumed a boundary condition which, for which you could still do the separation of variables. That's not a generic situation. That's the main change. But everything else goes through. All the asymptotic forms are still inverse square. It's still.
We've been hearing people having problems with the equation.
Yeah.
And then some of us switch over to the vacuum at the room potential. And that's designed to keep the potential short range.
Yeah. So
near the boundary, again, you have anyways.
Yeah.
And that seems to cure a lot of these numerical problems.
Well, that's interesting. Okay. If I didn't have a job, I would have been here yesterday. So actually, but the talks are online, I think, right? So I'll look for those.
Have you tried taking a metric that's close to Schwarzschild but not Schwarzschild? Does that metric calculate how that translates to these boundary conditions?
Depends what you mean. So. You mean like take a specific metric just out of the air and just as arbitrary functions rather than something coming from a set of field equations? Or
sure, I mean, if you want one more, choose like a very compact star or something, or you could just choose something at Schwarzschild, like take something to prepare the horizon. But presumably, if you have any metric that's close to a black hole, then
right.
Use those metric questions to translate to boundary conditions?
I think you can. There's two ways I can imagine that to going. One would be if the way I change things is by like going to Brand's daycare or something where I put some other degrees of freedom. I can imagine that some story goes through, but you have to follow the boundary condition for the new field. But if the rules are that it's just really gravity at long distances, so maybe like it's a compact source which is not a black hole, like you were saying, but where the gravitational field is differing from a black hole, but only appreciably as you get close to the horizon. I'm not sure in that case whether I have the hierarchy I want, that the difference from general from the black hole geometry is kicking in on scales small compared to the horizon. It's probably going to kick in on scales of order of the horizon. And so my hierarchy might not.
So say I just look up a metric that's like that, then you can do this.
Then you can, yeah.
New metric to solve the Klein-Gordon equation.
If you have a metric like that, then so there's a sense in which we did do that. But what we actually really did was we know how everything flows. And so that I can translate in principle. What I would do is I take that metric, I translate it into a flow equation for H, because the metric is going to change the potential, and the potential changes how the mode functions go, and then that changes how the flow goes. And we know how the observables depend on this flow for any flow. So then it's a question of just putting in for that specific flow as a function of the parameters in the metric. But we haven't actually done that translation for a specific metric. But if you have a metric that you think is interesting enough to try, we could do it.
I think we should oh sorry, Eric, maybe last question.
Okay, just yeah. I think the second statement, you compare the theoretical to a numerical expansion in the very beginning. That people don't know how to handle this on numerically.
Yes, right. That was what
that would to how people do that theoretically. I mean not here, but maybe paper.
Yeah, right? I would say
yes.
Where does it numerically? It's just mathematically. They're getting well those equations.
Yes, that's
right. That's the issue.
And a boundary conditions or other things you would need.
But that's not really a numerical.
Well, I would say it's numerical in the sense that issue of principle is not we know that it's not an issue of principle in the sense that we know that there's a class of, if you're in the regime where you could do things perturbatively, you know how to distinguish between the solutions that you trust and the ones that are runaways. So they're there, but the statement about effective field theories is that they capture the time dependence for a class of solutions. And it's not that you take all the solutions to effective field theory and believe them. And so what's tricky numerically is how do you pick out the ones that are the ones that you believe and the ones you don't believe, because the ones that you don't believe are the ones that are blowing up in your face. So I think it's a pressing question numerically. I think it's true that there's a question of principle there, but it's kind of you really hit it when you're doing it numerically.
I mean, it's something you have to face.
Yeah.
To do the variance, but it's already, just in a mathematical statement about Lopez, that's something about all the wavelengths, right?
Right. No. Well. No. Actually. So the statement perturbatively, I think that's understood. That if you're.
The way I'm saying some equations in those numerical statements, something about have numerical statements that are pick some solution and let them look at the deviations from around that solution, but you're allowed to like go to arbitrarily small wavelengths as long as it's sort of arbitrarily on a power of those wavelengths, right? That's the problem.
Right, but the party line on that, I think is a true party line, is that that if you had analytic control, then what you could do is the assertion is that the effective theory is capturing the full, first of all, adiabatic evolution in the full theory, order by order in the small parameter. And typically these things that are growing up, they're growing like exponentials of one over the small parameter. So they're things that you can identify as being not order by order. So you kind of can identify the blowing up solutions and you know why they're not trustable. So the thing is
that was my question. How did you do that theoretically?
Well, in practice, theoretically, what you would do if you could do it analytically, if you take a toy model where you can do everything, then it's not hard because there's a paper, maybe because someone else that I know is going to speak at the coffee break, I can kind of.
Okay, yes, let's do that. But,
yeah, I think that's a good idea. So let's sign clip again. Yeah.